The Republicans were confident, the Democrats tortured, and a third-party candidate hoped to become a power broker, reflecting on an election for the ages 50 years later on The Political Junkie. I'm Ken Rudin. The goal of Richard Nixon, the Republican, was to appeal to forgotten Americans.
That was a huge revolt against LBJ and his leadership and the Democratic leadership and the failure to end the war in Vietnam.
But before Hubert Humphrey, the Democrat, could even think about victory, he knew he had to unite the party.
It was clear that we had to make a definitive statement independently for Humphrey. What he did deliver September 30th was a clear break with Johnson, but it was a responsible speech.
And George Wallace, the third-party candidate, knew he couldn't win. Instead, he hoped to force the election into the House of Representatives.
We felt like that we had some leverage there to be able to get some concessions out of them to do something about school segregation.
We'll remember the crucial 1968 presidential campaign coming up on a special edition of The Political Junkie, which starts right now.
You like Ike, I like Ike, everybody likes Ike
for president.
Add Ike to you, add Ike to me, I don't care how you quote it.
Come on and vote for Kennedy, vote for Kennedy, and we'll come out on top.
Vote for Richard Nixon and Henry Cabot Lodge, cause they're the ones to lead the USA.
Thanks for joining us, and welcome to episode 230 of The Political Junkie. I'm Ken Rudin. There were two distinct moods for the two major parties in the aftermath of their respective nominating conventions in 1968. For the Republicans, which nominated Richard Nixon in a controversy-free Miami Beach convention, it was pretty simple.
Let's win this one for Ike.
It wasn't so simple for the Democrats a month later in Chicago. Senator Abraham Ribicoff of Connecticut summed up the mood at a calamitous convention.
With George McGovern as president of the United States, we wouldn't have to have Gestapo tactics in the streets of Chicago.
Hubert Humphrey's worries were not just with the supporters of Eugene McCarthy, the Vietnam peace candidate who was refusing to endorse the vice president, or even George McGovern. He was also facing defections from conservative Democrats who liked what they were hearing from a third-party candidate, former Alabama Governor George Wallace.
They believe in free speech for everybody but me. They don't want me to speak free. They're the folks who want to use four-letter words, you know. And that's one thing the American citizen is tired of, is a breakdown of ethical moral values in this country.
1968 was a once-promising year that became tragic. A never-ending war that forced out a president, the assassination of two leaders, a convention city steeped in violence. Somehow, the nation had to compose itself, dry its eyes, decide its future, and elect a new president.
I was born by the river in a little tent. Oh, and just like the river I've been running ever since. It's been a long time coming, but I know a change gonna come.
It was not by chance that Richard Nixon decided to open the fall campaign in the city of Chicago, which only a few days earlier had been engulfed in violence. The contrast was unavoidable. There, in a Labor Day motorcade, he was greeted by 400,000 cheering people. And it gave Nixon an opportunity to lay out one of his key themes for the campaign.
This is a nation of laws, and as Abraham Lincoln has said, no one is above the law, no one is below the law, and we're going to enforce the law, and Americans should remember that if we're going to have law and order.
Law and order would be a regular theme for the former vice president, and in his commercials. This one showed a woman walking in what seemed to be a fairly deserted neighborhood at night.
Crimes of violence in the United States have almost doubled in recent years. Today, a violent crime is committed every 60 seconds. A robbery every 2.5 minutes. A mugging every 6 minutes. A murder every 43 minutes. And it will get worse unless we take the offensive. Freedom from fear is a basic right of every American. We must restore it.
Another theme was ending the war in Vietnam. This commercial showed the horrors from the battlefield.
Never has so much military, economic, and diplomatic power been used so ineffectively as in Vietnam. If after all of this time and all of this sacrifice and all of this support, there is still no end in sight, then I say the time has come for the American people to turn to new leadership, not tied to the policies and mistakes of the past. I pledge to you, we shall have an honorable end to the war in Vietnam.
And in case there were some doubts, there were these obvious questions.
How can a party that can't unite itself unite the nation? How can a party that can't keep order in its own backyard hope to keep order in our 50 states? How can a party that labels the results of its programs the Great Society ever find any real solutions? How can a party that lets the country get bogged down in an endless war against a fourth-rate military power promise anything but decades of conflict? How, in the light of all this, can the American people fail to see that the United States urgently needs new leadership?
Ken Kechigian is a Republican consultant from California and was a longtime Nixon aide. Ken, it's great having you on The Political Junkie.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Well, I'm wondering if those commercials brought you back to 1968, but also I would like to know, where was the Republican Party in 1968? They had lost in a landslide in 64, but they had a great midterm election in 66. They were on the road. They were coming back, on the rebound, and the Democrats seemed like they were imploding.
Well, there's no question of that. The 1966 midterm elections had a huge comeback for the party. As I recall, we won 47 House seats in that midterm election, and so the party was on a rebound, led by Richard Nixon, who had campaigned all over the country for Republican candidates, and actually took a great deal of credit for a lot of the Republican victories that year. So that was a huge revolt against LBJ and his leadership, and the Democratic leadership, and the failure to end the war in Vietnam, which America was getting slogged down into, and there was a lot of violence across the streets and the cities. And then I know I lived in New York at the time, and I felt some concerns walking the streets of New York myself. And I was a student at Columbia when we had the student protests, and then, of course, the riots after Martin Luther King was shot. So it was a time of great distress and anger and division.
What was your role in the 68 campaign? What did you do, and who'd you work with?
Well, I was a second-year law student still, so I had I was a staff assistant and research assistant. I reported to Alan Greenspan. Alan Greenspan was the domestic headed up the domestic policy team. And so I provided research and writing for whoever wanted it. I was just a young researcher and did what I was asked and did what I was told.
What did you make of the role of Nixon's running mate, Governor Spiro Agnew? He played the quintessential role of the bad cop, attack dog, whatever you want to think, whatever you want to call the running mate. Let me play a little part of a speech from Governor Agnew.
The student now goes to college to proclaim rather than to learn. The lessons of the past are ignored and obliterated in a contemporary antagonism known as the generation gap. A spirit of national masochism prevails, encouraged by an effete core of impudent snobs who characterize themselves as intellectuals. A law-abiding American who believes in his country needs a strong voice to articulate his dissatisfaction with those who seek to destroy our heritage of liberty and our system of justice. To penetrate the cacophony of seditious drivel emanating from the best publicized clowns in our society and their fans in the Fourth Estate.
Ken, Agnew didn't hold back on much, did he?
He didn't. He was chosen in that campaign to be the nominee because Nixon had seen him perform as governor of the state of Maryland and react to some mobs that had reacted there in the state, and he felt he was had a strong presence about himself. But I think one of the downsides there was that Agnew didn't have any national experience and or the background to deal with the politics at that intense national level, with that spotlight that you have there at the national level. So that was the one drawback in that campaign. He was a very bright guy, very attractive man with a good bearing about himself. And but I think probably could have used a little more experience at that national level before he, you know, came onto a national ticket. But I think he did the job that he was asked to do, and we should be a little modest in our criticism of him.
What I remember most about the time, at least, you know, going from the conventions where he left Miami Beach with a huge lead until the latter parts of the campaign, is that Nixon had this huge lead for much of the campaign, and then suddenly it just seemed to disappear as we approach Election Day. How come?
It was partly because Tom Wicker, I think, once wrote during the 68 election cycle, he says, nothing unites the Democrats like Richard Nixon, like their hatred for Richard Nixon. So as it became more and more likely that Nixon might become president, the Democrat machine got more and more united around the thought that they needed to prevent that from happening. And so the Democrat coalition, both on the left and in the union, among the unions, got much more motivated. That was part of it. The other part of it was that Humphrey made a really clean break from LBJ, and with that September 30 speech he delivered in Salt Lake City, where he would pledge that his first priority as president would be to end the war, and he would do so by stopping the bombing of North Vietnam as a acceptable risk for peace. And that was a huge clear departure from Lyndon Johnson's policies in Vietnam. And so all of a sudden, instead of seeing Humphreys being tied to LBJ and his policies in Vietnam, they saw him as being liberated. And Humphrey himself saw himself as liberated. And so he started campaigning with more passion and fervor and excitement. And the Eugene McCarthyites started coming home. And so the excitement among the Democratic Party and the unity element of it virtually exploded, and so the comeback began. And so the election, which was never going to be a landslide, and we knew there would be a comeback, but we didn't know it would happen that soon and that hard.
Well, in addition to the change in the Humphrey campaign, as you made the point of the September 30th speech and the anti-war Democrats who used to protest and revile him, basically came onto his side. But there was also a complaint about the Nixon campaign that Nixon was making vague statements, that he was almost like running not to lose, a prevent defense. Did you agree with that?
Well, probably there was some element of that when you have a good lead like that, you try to run what we call a zero defect campaign, and you try to run a mistake free campaign. And one way to run a mistake free campaign is to be a little more cautious and not get out front with statements and be a little less aggressive in campaign rhetoric. And so I think, you know, you might argue that he had lost a little bit of his edge and toned down some of the attack mode and some of the fervor. But you might argue that. But I think that was less of the issue than it was that that Humphrey was just making the comeback on his own and was becoming what he became what he's really good at, which is Hubert Humphrey was one of the great stump campaigners in modern American history, in my judgment. And he became invigorated. And then, of course, he started taunting President, you know, Richard, the candidate Nixon, and the press, as they found in post-election analyses, was much more favorable to Humphrey as well, and it all played well into Humphrey's hands.
When, you know, in the 50 years since this election, everything I've read and remember about the election was that it was supposed to be representing a big change. And yet, you know, when all was said and like 68 was like a monumentous historical election that where big change was involved. And yet, when all was said and done, Nixon defeated Humphrey with just 43% of the vote. Just 510,000 votes out of 73 million cast. The Republicans picked up only 5 seats in the Senate, 4 in the House. That doesn't sound like a change election, or am I reading it wrong?
No, it. I don't think you can. I think you're right. I think it's nothing like the change election you can argue that we had in 1980, you know, when I was working with Governor Reagan. And but I think to the other answer to that, Ken, is that you have to allow for the fact that George Wallace was the third candidate in that race, and he won 5 states. And I think arguably if George Wallace was not in the race and taking away from Nixon and detracting from that campaign, that you would have had a little bit more of a change election, but Richard Nixon was not he was a moderate conservative. He was not a major change agent in that sense. Although you have to realize that, also recognize that when he became president, he did some very huge things in terms of change.
50 years later, how would you assess Nixon's campaign in 68?
I think the campaign would be assessed as being, one that was strong and vigorous, but that was ultimately just caught in the end by, the cynical manipulation of the electoral process by Lyndon Johnson's a bombing halt and
the October surprise.
The October surprise, and as one said on Halloween night, Nixon got a trick, and Hubert Humphrey got a treat, and it certainly almost won the election for Hubert Humphrey, but that put the damper on, and certainly. Even though it was still one of the greatest political comebacks in history, it really put a damper on it. And I think at the end of the day, no matter how people look at it, you have to acknowledge that a maneuver like that 7 days before the election certainly had some intention, have some effect to help Hubert Humphrey win this election.
Ken Kajigian is a Republican consultant from California and was a longtime aide to Richard Nixon. Ken, thanks so much for being on the program.
You bet. Thank you.
If Richard Nixon was coasting in his bid to become the nation's 37th president, Hubert Humphrey was desperate. The vice president in an increasingly unpopular administration, led by Lyndon Johnson, Humphrey knew he would never win if he couldn't unite the Democratic Party. And he made it clear that, no matter how much the odds may have been stacked against him, he would run a positive campaign.
I do not intend to appeal to fear, but rather to hope. I do not intend to appeal to frustration, but rather to your faith. I shall appeal to reason and to your good judgment.
But his message wasn't resonating. Young people were still wary of his war policy. Eugene McCarthy, his rival for the nomination, would not come on board. His pleas for debates fell on deaf ears. Polls had him down double digits to Nixon. He was in trouble. But then came this, a nationally televised speech on September 30th from Salt Lake City, where he dramatically broke from LBJ on Vietnam.
As president, I would stop the bombing of the North as an acceptable risk for peace, because I believe it could lead to success in the negotiations and thereby shorten the war. In weighing that risk, and before taking action, I would place key importance on evidence, direct or indirect, by deed or word, of communist willingness to restore the demilitarized zone between North and South Vietnam. Now, secondly, I would take the risk that the South Vietnamese would meet the responsibilities they say they are now ready to assume in their own self-defense. I would move, in other words, towards de-Americanization of the war.
Ted Van Dyke, a senior advisor to Humphrey, wrote that speech, and it almost changed the course of the election.
I was surprised by the outcome. Johnson had deterred Humphrey twice earlier, weeks earlier, from issuing independent statements of his own, threatened him, said he would denounce him publicly. But finally, after the debacle of the convention, it was clear that we had to make a definitive statement independently for Humphrey. And Larry O'Brien and I conspired. We bought national television time and told Humphrey that, in fact, it was for the Vietnam speech, and so he had no option, really, but to deliver one. And what he did deliver September 30th was a clear break with Johnson, but it was a responsible speech. And I expected the morning after that it would have just a slight effect, but it was just electric. We did not receive any heckling for the remainder of the campaign from peace voters, only from Wallace voters on the right. It was just like somebody had pushed a button and everything had changed.
You know, you mentioned those hecklers. I mean, throughout, I guess, in the time since the convention and into September, it seems like almost anywhere where Humphrey campaigned, he was met by anti-war hecklers.
That's right, and it was very tough, and particularly tough on him because prior to assuming the vice presidency, he'd been the unchallenged leader of liberals nationally and in the Congress, and then he became trapped as Johnson's vice president in the war, and it was a very, very difficult period for him. I had urged him and helped get him nominated as vice president, but about a year into the Johnson presidency, it was clear that we'd made a terrible mistake, and I wished he'd just remained independent as a senator.
You were talking about what the reputation that Humphrey had prior to becoming vice president. I always think of this Tom Lehrer song.
Whatever became of Hubert? Has anyone heard a thing? Once he shone on his own, now he sits home alone and waits for the phone to ring. Once a fiery liberal spirit. Ah, but now when he speaks, he must clear it. Second fiddle's a hard part, I know, when they don't even give you a bow. We must protest this treatment, Hubert, says each newspaper reader.
I mean, I love that song, and I thought of it often, but after September 30th, Humphrey became his own man.
He did, and those last weeks of the campaign were quite thrilling. And in fact, the Sunday before the election, the Harris poll had us winning by 3 points. But as you know, and as the recent PBS series emphasized, just a few days before the election, Nixon intervened with President Chu, arranged that Chu would not bring South Vietnamese to the conference table. The peace negotiations were off, and it was sabotaged, and the momentum we were gaining really stopped. And the question became, would we make this public knowing about it? And it really was appropriate for Johnson to do so. He was the president. Nixon was flagrantly breaking the law in intervening in the diplomatic process. But after meeting with his advisors, Johnson decided not to do so. We did not break it publicly because, frankly, it would have been seen partly as partisan. Nixon would have denied it. There was no real point in it, but it was a shame, and so much has been different in the country because of the outcome of that election in 1968. Another heartbreaking thing, I must say, was for Johnson as well as Humphrey, you know, the Great Society achievements of 1965 were truly historic. The Civil Rights Act passed the previous year, Voting Rights Act, Federal Aid to Education, Medicare, Medicaid, a war on poverty. Nothing has ever been done so historically in such a short time for domestic reform. All that was buried by Vietnam, which was a tragedy.
One of the tragedies, I thought, was watching a tormented Hubert Humphrey, torn between his loyalty to Johnson and his desire for the war to come to an end.
Yeah, well, that had been going on for quite a long time. And one of the things that was interesting is when Johnson withdrew from the presidential race March 31, Humphrey delayed a long time in making a decision whether to run. In fact, he delayed so long that it was too late to enter any primaries against McCarthy and Kennedy. He'd have to go in conventions and caucus states. And one evening we over a drink, he said, well, I've got to make a decision. And he says, what do you think? I said, well, you've always wanted to be president. This is the best chance you'll ever have. He said, well, that's true. He said, but let me tell you, he says, I just have a gut feeling bad things are going to keep happening, and I'll just be engulfed by them. In fact, he was. He did finally decide to run, but he was engulfed. Robert Kennedy was murdered. There was the terrible divisiveness in the streets, and then the Chicago Convention. And the poor man really endured everything, and then nearly won, as it turned out, only to lose at the last minute.
When I think of another thing that happened at the last minute, it was October 29th when Eugene McCarthy finally endorsed him. That was obviously very late in the campaign, a week to go.
Let me say on McCarthy's behalf, when Robert Kennedy had been killed
in June,
McCarthy came to see Humphrey and said he would withdraw from the race if Humphrey would only make some minor moves toward his position on the war. He said otherwise his supporters wouldn't move with him. And Humphrey told him, well, he didn't think he was able to do so. I talked with him about it afterward and urged him to make some modest. I said it'd be worth it to get McCarthy's early endorsement. But he said he thought Johnson would be so angry and intemperate as a result of it, it would destroy everything. So
Humphrey was riding the momentum of his Salt Lake City speech. But what nearly put Humphrey over the top came on October 31st, just days before the election, in a nationally televised speech by President Johnson.
I have now ordered that all air, naval, and artillery bombardment of North Vietnam cease as of 8 a.m. Washington time, Friday morning. I have reached this decision on the basis of the developments in the Paris talks, and I have reached it in the belief that this action can lead to progress toward a peaceful settlement of the Vietnamese War.
For Nixon and the Republicans, they were stunned. It was what was later described as the October surprise, a decision meant to affect the election. For Ted Van Dyke and the Humphrey campaign, Johnson's move was welcomed. But it was not enough.
The post-election data showed that we, in the end, got all the peace votes. So where we lost that election was with, in a foretaste of what happened last year, was in blue-collar voters in places like Ohio and New Jersey, where the traditional Democratic vote went either to George Wallace or to Nixon. That's where we lost the election. It was among what we later have called Reagan Democrats, rather than among peace voters. We got the peace vote in the end, but it was not enough.
That was Ted Van Dyke, the senior advisor to Vice President Humphrey, who was with him every step of the way in 1968.
Helplessly hoping her harlequin hovers nearby, awaiting a word, gasping at glimpses of gentle true spirit, he runs, wishing he could fly, only to trip at the sound of goodbye.
Ted Van Dyke's concern about George Wallace was justified. The former Alabama governor, who briefly sought the Democratic presidential nomination 4 years earlier, this time was running a 50-state third-party campaign based on white resentment and safety in the streets.
Why are more and more millions of Americans turning to Governor Wallace? Follow as your children are bussed across town.
As president, I shall, within the law, turn back the absolute control of the public school systems to the people of the respective states.
Why are more and more millions of Americans turning to Governor Wallace? Open a little business and see what might happen.
As president, I will stand up for your local police and firemen in protecting your safety and property.
Wallace has the courage to stand up for America. Give him your support.
George Wallace was strong in the South and was expected to do well there, with conservatives who had voted for Barry Goldwater 4 years earlier and who might be expected to vote for Nixon. But Wallace was also making inroads in the North, in Ohio, in Michigan, in New Jersey, in states where his message was resonating with blue-collar whites who were members of labor unions and who usually voted for Democrats. Would he hurt the Democrats more? Would he hurt the Republicans more? It didn't matter. As Wallace would say,
today there's not a dime's worth of difference in the National Republican Party, in the National Democratic Party, and their approach to problems that confront the people of our nation.
Charles Snyder was Wallace's campaign manager in 1968, a campaign where at one point polls showed he was getting some 20% of the vote, with the possibility of the election getting thrown into the House.
You're exactly right, Ken. What we had in mind was that we felt like that we could get enough electoral votes to throw it into the House, and if we could get it into the House, then we felt like that we had some leverage there to be able to influence the candidate and at that time get some concessions out of him to do something about school segregation. It was a problem not only here in Alabama but all over, and that was one of the things that George had run on and several times. And it basically, not only through segregation, but it had to do with states' rights. In other words, he felt like that the states should have the authority to handle their own problems and their school system problems and that type thing. And another thing was a lot of polls that we had done indicated that that the people were dissatisfied.
In regard to that point, we know that third-party candidates don't get elected president. You know, they never have. You know that. Governor Wallace knew that. So did he ever think he could win, and was he running to win?
No, we never thought that we could win the election in 68. We had thoughts that we could win it in future years, but what we wanted to do in 68, we wanted to put him on the ballot in all 50 states. And in 68, we got 10 million votes. We got 45 delegates. What it told us was that, hey, the people out there are dissatisfied, and Wallace is acceptable in a lot of states and a lot of places where we didn't think that he was acceptable.
A few minutes ago, I played Wallace's famous not a dime's worth difference between the two parties. Did you see no difference between Nixon and Humphrey?
No, there was a difference in the two. There was no doubt about it. But this had to tell the people that there's an alternative and you can go as an independent. He said if you looked in all the briefcases of all the Democrats and the Republicans up there and so forth, all you'd find would be a peanut butter and jelly sandwich. So he was trying to say that. But no, the truth of the matter is we thought that the Nixon people were much more conservative than the Democratic side of it. Even though he was running as a Democrat, we knew the difference in the two.
At one point, Wallace had something like 20% in the polls, and he finished with 13.5%, and he carried 5 states. My question is, was that a success, or do you think he should have done better?
Well, no, that was probably as well as we could do. And we began to lose some of the conservative vote, and we began to lose some of the labor union type vote because they felt like that a vote for Wallace was a vote away from Richard Nixon, but what we pulled off was getting on the ballot in 50 states and getting 10 million votes, we thought was highly significant.
Well, let me play a little piece of tape, what Wallace said at a news conference the day after the election.
I want to emphasize that in our judgment, our movement has been successful. And I think that most of you probably thought a year ago that we not only wouldn't get on the 50 ballots in the country, but had someone asked you, would this ticket
get 10 million votes for the presidency a year ago, I think most of you would answer it in the negative. But we did get that many votes, and it was very significant that we got on all ballots in all 50 states.
So, Charlie, it sounds like Wallace considered it a big victory getting on the ballot in all 50 states and getting the 10 million votes, more so than really hoping for a victory.
Absolutely. We felt extremely good about it because we didn't know when we started out, but I don't think that anybody realized what it took to get on all 50 ballots. Getting it to the deadline in California, we carried probably, I'd say we had 150 to 200 Alabamians out there in California on street corners getting signatures. So, and then we got right down to the deadline. You know, we were just a few hours away from a lot of these states, and especially California and the other states, some of them were doing everything they could do to keep us from getting on the ballot. And, you know, after we did that in 68, then a lot of the states changed their rules and whatnot to keep somebody from getting on the ballot as a third-party candidate. So I don't think it would today, I don't think anybody could do it. But at the same time, we did it, and it was a lot of hard work, and it was done by a lot of Alabamians that we shuttled out all over the nation and whatnot to get signatures.
It had to be a very expensive effort, too, as well, to get on all 50 states' ballots, right?
Absolutely. And, I want you to stick to 68, but in 72, as a candidate, as a Democratic candidate, we met all kind of opposition from various states to keep Wallace off, even as a Democratic candidate.
Looking back 50 years later, how would you assess the Wallace campaign of 1968?
I think the Wallace campaign in 68 turned this whole country around. I think it brought about the thinking that the people wanted to get public and had not had a leader prior to that time to allow them to do so. And I think that was a turnaround of the conservative movement in this country. And I think Jimmy Carter picked up on that and carried it forward. And then that began to reflect on the Republican Party all along. And now you got the Republicans considered conservatives and Democrats liberals. So I think George Wallace and his efforts in 68 was absolutely the birth of that.
Charlie Snyder was a key player on the George Wallace 1968 campaign. He was the former governor of Alabama who carried 5 states and nearly 10 million votes as a third-party presidential candidate. Charlie, it was great having you on the program.
Enjoy talking to you, Ken.
A postscript on Wallace. 3 years ago, I interviewed his son, George Wallace Jr., who insisted that any portrayal of him as a racist was an unfair and incomplete characterization. Here's an excerpt from that conversation.
I realize more than most that my father's is defined by a couple of images, segregation forever and schoolhouse door, and those were certainly part of his journey, but it was not the total journey. At one time in his life, he did support segregation, and he told me over the years, as he told John Kennedy Jr. and others, that he was raised in an era, having been born in 1919, almost 100 years ago, that with the belief, and he was taught, that segregation was in the best interest of both races. That's what people generally of the South believed. And it was not accepted with ill will or ill feeling or malice. It's just a sense they had that it was in the best interest of both races and that anything other than that could bring about adverse relations. But he believed that until time passed and his conscience told him he was wrong about that, at which time he went to Dr. King's church and told the congregation he'd been wrong and asked for their forgiveness. He was so charismatic, Ken, and dynamic and defined in terms of the federal government and the battle between the sovereignty of the states and the federal government and the 10th Amendment Reserve Clause, you know, all those things. Many people took it as ill feeling toward black people, and it was never that. He did believe in segregation at one time. But that's concerned me. Another thing, the violence at the Edmund Pettus Bridge, many people don't realize this, and I was on Larry King Live several years ago with Jesse Jackson and Mike Wallace, and when Mike was still with us, and was able to talk about the fact that his orders at the Edmund Pettus Bridge were disobeyed. the last thing he wanted was violence. And it had been decided that the marchers cross the bridge, allow them to march. He would contact President Johnson, determine how to protect the marchers, because unbeknownst to many people, there were rumors about groups such as the Minutemen and others who planned to have snipers along Highway 80 from Selma to Montgomery. And that concerned my father deeply. So when he got the word in his office, as written by Bob Ingram, who was with the Montgomery Advertiser at the time, when he learned of the violence, he wrote that he'd never seen a man as enraged in his life as he saw my father when he learned what happened at the bridge. So that bothered him until the day he died, and he called John Lewis on several occasions, and I know John Lewis, and he related to him that his orders were disobeyed. The last thing he wanted was violence. Became very emotional, John Lewis says, as he talked about it. So my father was a good and decent man who was on the wrong side of an issue early on, but got things right and worked to bring about, nurture our common humanity, and I think that's a great lesson for us all.
That was George Wallace Jr., the son of the Alabama governor and presidential candidate, in an interview back in 2015.
From north to south, to east to west, listen and you'll hear the voice of George C. Wallace ringing loud and clear. He's speaking to America, his words are wise and true. And if you really love your country, here's what you'll do. Stand up for America. Let's vote to keep it free. We're about to be destroyed by a great society.
The 1968 election was one of the closest in American history. Richard Nixon won with just 43.4% of the vote, defeating Hubert Humphrey by some 510,000 votes out of 73 million cast. In the Electoral College, however, it was another story. Nixon 301, Humphrey 191. George Wallace received just under 10 million votes, 13.5% of the total, and 46 electoral votes. Nixon was gracious in victory.
I congratulated him for his gallant and courageous fight against great odds. I admire a fighter, and he proved himself to be one. He never gave up, and he gave us a good fight. And I hope that all of those that supported Mr. Humphrey and will continue their interest in politics. They will perhaps be in the other party. We may be contesting again. Who knows? But the important thing is that our process in this country works better when we have devoted, dedicated people giving their all in battle for a cause that they believe in. And I would urge particularly the young people who supported him and lost not to be discouraged, but to continue their interest and to go on to other areas of public service.
Humphrey was equally gracious.
Please know that you will have my support in unifying and leading the nation. This has been a difficult year for the American people. I'm confident that if constructive leaders of both our parties join together now, we shall be able to go on with the business of building the better America we all seek in a spirit of peace and harmony. Signed, Hubert H. Humphrey.
And so was George Wallace.
And I do wish for Mr. Nixon the most success of any president in the history of our country. And I sincerely hope that he can unify the people of our nation and that the problems that government ought to solve can be solved by him as the chief executive of our country, because I'm an American and I want his administration to be highly successful.
1968 was a big year for Richard Nixon and the Republican Party, especially in the battle for the Senate, where the GOP picked up 5 seats. One of the new winners that year was Bob Packwood, a 36-year-old state representative from Oregon who was challenging veteran Democratic incumbent Wayne Morris. Senator Packwood, welcome to the Political Junkie.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
Well, that was, a memorable Senate race, of course, running against Wayne Morris, the well-known long-term Democratic senator there. But let me just say something about Morris for a second before we go on. The nation was clearly turning against the war in Vietnam, and Wayne Morris was a leading opponent of the war. who was probably best remembered for being one of two senators who voted against the Gulf of Tonkin resolution in 64. Let me play a bit of Wayne Morse explaining why he voted that way.
So I am not going to go along with this kind of a program in South Vietnam, at least with my vote, but in my judgment is going to kill needlessly untold numbers of American boys and for nothing.
The thing is, Senator Packwood, what I remember about Morse back then is that his views were not that dissimilar from Mark Hatfield, and yet voters loved Hatfield, and they soured on Morse. How come?
Well, do you know the background?
Tell me.
Very quickly, here was Morse's background. He is elected to the Senate in 1944 as a Republican, defeating a Republican incumbent. So all the incumbent's Republican friends are mad. He's in the Senate. He votes against the Taft-Hartley Act. So now they're mad again. In 1952, he supports Eisenhower over Taft, but when Stevenson gets the nomination, he supports Stevenson.
The Democrat.
Yeah. So now the Republicans, all the Republicans are mad at him. And then in 1960, he starts to irritate Democrats. The race was boiling down to Kennedy and Humphrey. Morse files for president in Oregon. The Humphrey people are furious because they think he'll split the vote and Kennedy will win. So now you've got some mad Democrats. But the absolute key was in 1966 when Hatfield was running for the Senate. He was a dove, Mark, and Morse was a dove. The Democratic candidate was a good candidate, but he was a hawk. Morse now crosses party lines and supports Hatfield. Now, all of the people now are mad at Morse. I mean, he has that entire background when I run against him. And almost every group that he irritated they would not support him.
What were you hearing from voters on the war on Vietnam in 1968?
Despite Senator Morse, it had not yet bubbled to the top as a passionate main issue, except among some students. In fact, if there was anybody, it was almost students. But it was not a major factor in Oregon for either Nixon or for me in my race against Senator Morse.
I know that by running in 68, you were focusing on your Senate race. But when you think of 68, when you think of Nixon and Humphrey and the war and Wallace and race and all those things, what are the memories that really sticks with you 50 years later?
Well, one of the memories that sticks with me is Gene McCarthy beating Bobby Kennedy in the Oregon primary, you know, a couple of weeks before the California primary.
One week,
okay. And McCarthy, just the public in Oregon took to him. They didn't dislike Bobby. They just took to McCarthy. What I remember about the president, when he's running in Oregon, Oregon always has been a very socially liberal state, both on civil rights and almost all women's issues. They've had five ballot issues on abortion, and pro-life force had lost them all badly. But even back in the 60s, Oregon was a liberal state in those areas. And Nixon, in his, people say the Southern strategy, and it may have been, but it did not hurt him in Oregon. It just wasn't that big an issue at the time. It was one thing to be mad at Mark Rudd and the radicals. It was another for the sort of subliminal Nixon campaign about the Southern strategy. That wasn't something, as you recall, obviously, that the Nixon campaign bragged and boasted about.
You know, when I think of Oregon back in these days, I always think of Hatfield and Packwood. It's like Thurmond and Hollings. You know, Hatfield and Packwood were the two senators from Oregon forever. The thought of Oregon today electing Republicans to the Senate, I don't know if it far-fetched is the word, but the Republican Party has changed a lot since 1968.
In the 60s and the 70s, especially in the legislature, the Republicans were the liberal party. So it was the House Republicans that were liberal, and the party was liberal, and people have to be careful about that word, but they were certainly moderate to left on what I would call social issues. That has totally changed now.
Bob Packwood was elected to the Senate from Oregon in 1968 and was reelected four more times. Senator Packwood, thank you so much for being on the program.
Good to talk with you. Thanks a lot.
You turn my whole world upside down.
2, 3, 4.
Things are looking up. Things are looking up. I couldn't find the star in the sky, but now that I've found us, things are looking up. Even when I'm down, had about enough. Looking at the ground, I couldn't find the star in the sky, but now that I've found us, things are looking up.
One who intimately knows Richard Nixon through decades as a political journalist is Elizabeth Drew. She memorably covered the Watergate scandal and wrote a biography of Nixon in 2007. Another one of her books, Washington Journal, Reporting Watergate and the Downfall of Richard Nixon, has been reissued and expanded. In a previous life, she was the Washington correspondent for the Atlantic Monthly and the New Yorker, and is currently writing for the New Republic. Elizabeth, it's great having you on the program.
I'm happy to be here, Ken.
Well, tell me, what would you say was the significance of the 1968 election?
Oh, I think it was a real turning point in the politics of the country and certainly in both parties, because it was the, first of all, it was the election of Richard Nixon, which started a whole new kind of politics. And Nixon ran on something we've come to call the Southern Strategy, and he really ran a race-based politics, among other things. It was the very, very, very tight race between Nixon and Hubert Humphrey, and Humphrey barely lost, but he lost. And this opened up a whole new look at the Democratic Party. Humphrey was really the last establishment nominee of the Democratic Party. And then we had George Wallace injecting his own, it was really a blue-collar Southern white strategy. It's the same one that Nixon picked up. So a lot of things came together. It was a fight over the end of the Vietnam War, which didn't end for another 5 years, but it could have ended that year. We learned later that Nixon had messed around with the Paris peace talks and had gotten word to the South Vietnamese leaders, don't settle, we'll give you a better deal. And, of course, he didn't. It was a sad year. It was a year of triumphs, but also a year of great tragedies. It was too dramatic for our own good, in a way. But the incredible was the end of the election when Humphrey was gaining on Nixon, and he was begging Johnson, and others were begging Johnson, to halt the bombing of North Vietnam. And because otherwise Humphrey just could not get the anti-war vote. And Johnson finally did halt the bombing, but it was too late. And everybody thought that, many people thought, had the nomination fight, had the election gone on for another week, Humphrey could have won. But, you know, you don't get to pick the day the election is. So it was a real squeaker.
I was going to say, but even before Johnson stopped the bombing in the end of October, Humphrey gave his own speech in the end of September that finally broke with Johnson on the war policy.
Well, he did and he didn't. This was the terrible dilemma that Humphrey was in. He was his vice president. Johnson treated him horribly. I took a trip with Humphrey while he was vice president to go look at some project somewhere. And we were flying out there, and he was just in tears, literally in tears, telling me how Johnson treated him. So, but Johnson was still the party, still had the structure of the party, and so Humphrey couldn't completely break with him. And that was his problem.
Elizabeth Drew is a veteran political journalist and author of numerous books, including Washington Journal, Reporting Watergate and the Downfall of Richard Nixon, which has been reissued and expanded. She is currently writing for the New Republic. Elizabeth, it was wonderful having you on the show.
Well, thank you. It was delightful to talk to you.
So what really happened in 1968, and what did we learn from it? Michael Flam is a professor of history at Ohio Wesleyan University and the author of Law and Order, Street Crime, Civil Unrest, and the Crisis of Liberalism in the 1960s. Professor Flam, welcome to The Political Junkie.
Thank you for inviting me.
Well, we've heard Richard Nixon and George Wallace use the catchphrase law and order throughout the 68 campaign. But we both know, everybody seems to know, that expression means different things to different people. So I guess my opening question is, what role did that expression play back then and you know, in the politics of that time?
Law and order was the most important political issue in the 1968 election. And what made it such a brilliant political phrase for conservatives like Nixon and Wallace was that it served as a sort of Rorschach test. Anxious voters could read into that phrase, that statement, law and order, whatever anxiety was foremost in their minds at the time. Some were concerned above all about crime in their neighborhoods, crime on their streets. Others were worried about the social change, the sexual revolution, the women's movement, the drug issue. Some were worried about unrest on college campuses. And, you know, some were concerned about civil unrest, riots and rebellions in America's cities. So it was a perfect slogan for conservatives to use to mobilize and energize their base.
Is it fair to say that all those concerns you just listed, and that was pretty comprehensive, but all those concerns, they were legitimate concerns? I mean, whatever the Great Society had brought to the country, there was unease and uncertainty, and certainly Nixon and Wallace capitalized on that.
There were legitimate concerns, and I have no doubt that most white voters sincerely had those concerns, those anxieties, whether it was about long hair or drugs and hippies or protests on campuses or crime in the streets or rebellions in the cities. There is an issue about the extent to which race is embedded within law and order, and there is a debate over the extent to which it's code for some voters, but my research indicates that most voters were suffering from real anxieties and had real issues and concerns about the change that was taking place in their world. So race was part of it, but I think overwhelmingly there were, as you say, legitimate concerns, grievances, fears at the bottom of it.
Yeah, I was just going to expand on that because I'm fascinated by this argument because I remember, you know, back then we always heard about the term white backlash, and then that became a dog whistle to racism. How would you describe Nixon's use of the words like law and order? Was it race? Was it opportunism? Or was it, you know, a concern that things were simply coming apart at the seams?
Nixon uses it very deliberately and I think constructively. Nixon is running as a conservative, but he's also running as a moderate conservative. Here, I must say, as a historian, I need to sort of give you some background or context. Law and order was a phrase that was frequently used in the South by segregationist politicians and sheriffs against civil rights activists. So there is a history here to the use of this phrase, law and order. It's used against those who are fighting for racial justice in the South. And it's important also that the politician who brings the phrase law and order into national presidential politics is Barry Goldwater in 1964. Now, in my opinion, Goldwater was not personally a racist. There's plenty in his background to suggest that, in fact, he was in favor of racial integration, although gradually, and without government intervention. But Goldwater was one of only six Republican senators to vote against the Civil Rights Act of 1964. And so when he utters this phrase, law and order, there's a lot of racial baggage attached.
It's like states' rights, right?
Exactly. It's like states' rights. Now, by contrast, Nixon had quite a moderate, even progressive record on civil rights as a Republican politician coming up. And he did not vote against, of course, the Civil Rights Act. He was not in Congress at the time, but nor did he oppose it. And in fact, Nixon uses law and order to argue, you know, that the problem is not with the Civil Rights Act. The problem is the way that nonviolent civil disobedience has been misused by some. And so it's sort of a way to indirectly attack violence that is associated with African Americans. But I don't think that Nixon is using it as a sort of dog whistle, although this is a point that is debated among scholars.
Plus the fact that as Nixon was using that term law and order, so was George Wallace.
George Wallace was. And interestingly, George Wallace, by being a more extreme conservative, a reactionary, in some ways buffers Nixon from that charge, because Nixon is able to point to his more progressive record on civil rights and to suggest that he's not using it in the same way. So I think, I mean, Wallace is important for allowing Nixon to pose as the more moderate, responsible conservative in the race.
So what is your ultimate verdict on that expression? Is it legitimate? Is it, as we talked about, was it a dog whistle, or was it a reaching out to people who were genuinely concerned about the decay in society?
Well, let me say, first of all, I'm always hesitant to ascribe motivations or intentions to people. I don't think there's any doubt that some politicians use law and order as a dog whistle to reach voters who held racist beliefs. I think other politicians used it because it was a legitimate issue in 1968. The country seemed to be coming apart at the seams. Violent crime was increasing. There was civil unrest in virtually every major U.S. city. There were demonstrations and protests on campus. There was a tremendous amount of social change that was upsetting more traditional Americans. Among voters, I will say there were no doubt some white voters, particularly in the South and parts of the North, who read race into the issue of law and order. But I think most voters, most white, middle-class, middle-aged voters in middle America were voting for law and order because they had real and legitimate fears and concerns and anxieties.
And I think there was a sense that there was so-called liberalism that was governing the country for the last 8 years. That was seen as a failure.
Yes, and that was another brilliant move by the Nixon campaign in 1968. Brilliantly sort of flips the Democratic argument on its head. So in 1964, when law and order first becomes an issue, Lyndon Johnson says, well, we're going to get to the root causes of this problem through our war on poverty, through our Great Society programs. Well, by 1968, there's more crime, there's more disorder, there's more fear in America, and Nixon is able to say, what the Democrats, what the liberals, in fact, have done is reward the rioters. These programs, these liberal social programs, have not only failed to get at the root causes of this disorder and unrest in America, they've made it even worse. And it's an act of political jujitsu, brilliant political jujitsu by the Nixon campaign. I just want to add one more point about law and order. This is very important. Many people still believe that the Vietnam War was the most important issue in 1968. The fact of the matter is that by October, by the stretch run of the campaign, most voters, certainly most white middle-class voters, no longer see any major difference on the Vietnam issue between Humphrey and Nixon. By contrast, they see a wide difference between the two candidates on law and order, and by an overwhelming margin, they favor the Nixon approach. And that's why law and order is so cutting and so important in 1968.
Michael Flam is a professor of history at Ohio Wesleyan University and the author of Law and Order, Street Crime, Civil Unrest, and the Crisis of Liberalism in the 1960s. He also has a new book, In the Heat of the Summer, The New York Riots of 1964 and the War on Crime. Michael, thank you so much for being on the program.
Thank you for having me.
Whatever your view of the events of 1968, it's clear that we are still recovering from its aftershocks. Yes, it was a horrible year, not just because of the war in Vietnam or the upheaval in the streets or the burning cities or the assassinations of our leaders or increased racial distrust or a presidential campaign that focused on divisive and sometimes hateful themes, although none of that helped. It also exposed the worst this country had to offer to its people and to the world. It led to distrust and anger, radicalization and despair. And many of those feelings remain with us today. The old demons haven't completely gone away, and sadly, new demons have arrived as well. That's it for our three-part series on The Political Junkie, looking back at the political events of 1968. If you missed the first two episodes in our series, you can listen to them on our website, krpoliticaljunkie.com. While you're there, be sure to subscribe to our podcast and our weekly email newsletter. Also, we'd like to remind you that The Political Junkie is entirely made possible by your generous contributions. We are so grateful to all of our listeners who help us to bring you programs like our 1968 series. We would love it for you to join them and help support this endeavor. You can make a contribution at krpoliticaljunkie.com/donate. And thank you so much. If you've got comments or questions, send an email to Ken at krpoliticaljunkie.com. You can also tweet us at Ken Rudin and at Ken Rudin Junkie, or follow the show on Facebook. And you can follow my button of the day on Instagram at The Political Junkie. Political Junkie is distributed by PRX, the Public Radio Exchange. The show is produced by Devin Maverick Robbins, and Douglas Bell is our coordinating producer and engineer. I'm Ken Rudin. Thanks for listening.